You're listening to another episode of Open Source CXO, the podcast designed to share insights on how to excel in your business using technology, regardless of the industry. Host Robert Kehoe is a self-taught software developer who has grown to the role of CEO. Renowned for his collaborations with organizations such as Stanford University, Nelnet, and Louis Vuitton, he continually seeks new challenges to conquer in the world of tech. Accompanying him is Don Blackburn, a veteran COO with over 25 years of experience in cultivating diverse relationships and driving innovation in various technical projects. Each week, they'll be sitting down with some of the nation's foremost technology leaders to develop an open source playbook, drawing from their firsthand experiences in the field. Let's talk some tech.
Today on our podcast, our guest is Nick Ide. Welcome, Nick.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Nick is with Ascend Learning. So why don't you tell the folks a little bit about Ascend Learning and your role there?
Sure, absolutely. At Ascend Learning, I'm the VP of Software Engineering for our healthcare segment. So we change lives is our mission, and as it applies to helping people prepare for professions across healthcare, fitness and wellness, safety and security. So your doctors, nurses, personal trainers, and so on. You know, so we provide tools and solutions to help them be successful both before certification as well as after. So we want to make sure we keep those connections and keep them learning and helping them help others out in the world.
Yeah. But how do you measure like the success and how do you measure that performance? Let's say, you know, they're
back. What is productive?
Yeah. What technically is productive? And honestly, you guys have a global team is what it seems like. So from my experience, you know, productivity levels are vastly different between, you know, various, you know, so it really just depends. How do you guys measure that? And what, I guess, what is productive to you guys?
Yeah. You know, philosophically, it all kind of starts with a say do, you know, of do what you say you're going to do. And, you know, obviously that's something that Agile tracks out of the gate, but what say do doesn't give you, especially at the sprint level, is did I meet the customer's needs, right? You're just, all it's proven is that you did work that you said that you would do, but how did I know that it was the most important work? Did you complete the task or the act, you know, the objective that you set out to do? So, you know, we've continued to look at new metrics and ways of determining, you know, business value contribution, like how much impact are our teams actually having on the business. There are very clear deliverables that we need to meet for, you know, revenue purposes, for efficiency purposes, or whatever that is. And we want to make sure that our teams are oriented on that rather than just, we plan this sprint, complete this sprint, right? Like there's no success until the objective is met. So how do we make sure that those objectives are brought forward and they're really the center of the conversation? And so then the say-do really becomes our commitment to the customer rather than to our product owner or, you know, or whoever's, you know, kind of made the request of the team. So it's a bit of a shift. I think that this is kind of the trap that metrics can put you in, or even that Agile can put you in, is, hey, if I'm just doing the next prioritized thing, that I'm winning, I'm successful, right? But if we're not shipping software, if we're not meeting the customer's needs, then we haven't.
That seems like it would be a very difficult thing to track. So how does that work with you guys? How does that trickle down? I imagine you don't let every person in the organization be responsible for, you know, the client's particular needs. Obviously, that's what the true value at the end of the day is, but how do you guys decide, okay, well, you know, this developer, his velocity's up, he's getting stuff done, he's knocking stuff out. Whose responsibility is it ultimately to determine, okay, this didn't actually meet the need? Is that trickle down from you know, from the top down? Is the team leads that are responsible for that? I guess, how does that work? I'd be curious to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it starts with a great relationship with your product partners. And one of the things I've always been blessed with is just fantastic product people in my career. And so that vision can be a shared vision, right? Yeah, okay. Like I'm not responsible.
Pretty seamless then.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not responsible for just, you know, doing what I'm told, but no, I'm bought in. Like I understand why we're going to do that and then make sure that then gets transitioned down, you know, to the teams, that they understand that vision. So then the product managers and the product owners and everyone that's touching and responsible for this is kind of moving together as a unit rather than having that work just thrown over the wall. Yeah, I just, because again, I think that it's that Covey principle, begin with the end in mind, right? Like everyone needs to understand what we're trying to achieve here at the end of the day, and that agile metrics don't alone demonstrate your success, right? Because you can be hitting your feature say do's and all these things out that, you know, blowing those out of the water. But if you haven't, you know, met the needs or fulfilled the scope of the work to be able to meet the needs of the customer, then we haven't done it.
Sure. Yeah. Do you guys do daily stand-ups with your teams?
Depends on the team. We give a lot of latitude to our teams within their agile journey. Because again, at the end of the day, you know, the framework is just that. It's just a framework to help get people started. Mm-hmm. And we want teams to then be able to navigate their journey kind of on their own with some guide rails, right? Of course.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a firm believer in that, you know, Scrum, for instance, is just kind of agile 101, but then the team itself kind of has to find its way and then move into those more advanced practices and push themselves into a higher evolutionary form, you know, right. And what you have to avoid is then that team just getting stuck in step one.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, hey, we're doing agile. Great. And then 4 years later, we're still doing things the same way, right? Like, and you haven't evolved. And if you're not really embracing that vision of the self-directed high-performing team, and you're not embracing the aspects of continuous improvement, then what are we doing, right? You've just changed the structure of how you consume and execute work, but you've really not bought into what I feel is the most important aspect of being agile.
So one question that I had, we talked a little bit about, obviously you guys are having, you know, your folks come in at least one day a week. Sometimes it's more. How does that work when you have, I mean, do you guys have office, obviously have multiple offices, but that collaboration is very important. How does that work if you have a team in Latin America or, you know, offshore? Like, are you, do you guys see yourself kind of trending away from that model, or are you just trying to build teams in those areas that still can get together? I'm curious how that, I was thinking it purely from, oh, everybody's in Kansas, like we are, you know, we do have people who come in often enough. They work together. If our guys want to get together on a project, and we have a whole wall in there that's a whiteboard. So they'll whiteboard stuff out, talk about things, really get through things. And it's great. They're not always here. Cause like you said, they could do some of their work at home. They could be, you know, performance-wise, it's fine. You know, we have that collaboration.
Yeah.
How does that work having a distributed team like that?
It's difficult to say the least, but we put a high emphasis on communication, right? So this is where when you talk about interviewing process, this becomes really important, especially with our nearshore and offshore individuals, is that we really have to have people where their communication capabilities are on point and they're very effective, because of that geographic time frame, in those rare moments of overlap or those limited moments of overlap that we have, the communication has to be tight and it has to be clear, because when we go to bed here and then the work begins,
they're just spinning their wheels,
side,
you know?
Right? Yeah. And so we try to make sure that we, you know, because we have onshore contractors that also help with some of the facilitation with our offshore team.
Okay.
And then that's been a great success for us, you know, having that model. But again, those folks that we have in that role that are here have to be, you know, the best communicators to make sure that those teams that they're supporting from their role really understand those intimate details that were discussed today in that ARC review or in that refinement discussion to make sure that their work is going to, you know, be implemented in the appropriate way.
Now, do you guys see your team as ours versus theirs? Like, do you see a difference in the team itself? Like, does that question make sense?
Between offshore and onshore?
Yeah,
or
nearshore.
Agile teams?
Well, I guess maybe even both, but just, do you see a difference, you know, are they a part, do you measure their performance differently? Yeah, offshore specifically. Do you measure their performance differently? Do you handle them differently than you would in your internal, I don't know how else to put it, but.
And then my question would be, are they part of your team here? So if you have a development team doing a particular project, is it scattered with, or littered with, I got two people from the offshore team on this Or is it, you know, the offshore team?
Or is your team your own project? They're all one, you know.
Yeah.
Do you keep them totally separated?
No, we don't separate them, right? They're part of our agile teams that own and manage disparate systems, right? So we don't do project work. I think that that's where you can get into trouble sometimes, where you're just kind of, you know, farming out, like, you know, off
siloing project.
Right. And so we have longstanding great relationships with our vendors to be able to get the right candidates who also, again, our values still apply, like even for our contract resources and then making sure we've got the right skills aligned to the problems that those teams are being asked to solve. So I think that that's a really, really important aspect, and that, yeah, there is no us versus
them. So you measure them in the same way then?
Yes,
you measure their performance, everything's still the same. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talk about expectations, even we align with job roles and expectations to where, hey, when we talk about engineering managers and what they need to be focusing on and what they need to be driving, what they need to be doing, that needs to be aligned to that same role on our side, right? So those expectations are clear. So we've got great partners, but we had to work through some of that to make sure that we're all on the same page and aligned. So, yeah.
Makes sense.
But the us versus them is another kind of culture aspect. You talk about like competition, right? Mm-hmm. Competition be a good thing, you know, pushing, challenging, implementation of AI within the day-to-day lives of our engineers has been great, because you can see the wheels turning within different pockets and stuff, and how that's inspiring, getting other people kind of excited. And you want that type of competition. I think that's good, because it helps kind of maximize the effectiveness of tools and technology that we're working on. But what we don't want is, you know, competition at the cost of our customers, where you've got one team racing ahead to the finish line, standing there saying, hey, we did it,
yep,
right? And then but only to find out that we failed as a team, you know, the royal we, because we didn't all do it, you know, we didn't do this together. And that's, you know, as a scaling, growing company, like that's a problem that oftentimes can happen more often than not, right?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it really comes down to where you source, like in making sure, I think when I got moved into being a new hiring manager, you kind of get connected with recruiters, and you kind of like, oh, you find, you know, kind of a couple of relationships, people who work well for you, and that kind of becomes your go-to. And then they kind of have their books that are full with certain candidates, and those certain candidates kind of fill a certain criteria. And then, but I think we as hiring managers can't push the easy button when it comes to finding the best talent possible. Right. Which means I think we've got to have a wider kind of net to be, you know, whether it's across, you know, apprenticeship programs or through college campus recruiting, through, you know, training programs and then recruiters and other avenues, right, to be able to make sure that we're, really kind of overturning stones and to find the best talent we possibly can. And that's where, you know, I think bias absolutely comes into it. That's where culture comes into this, is then it does though help the skills and the culture are what matter. Right. And we want to make sure that we're never violating, you know, that. But we're also putting in the groundwork to be able to discover, you know, all kinds of different sources where we can get the best people possible.
Yeah.
Because that.
And I know naturally though, like, you know, it's so. I'd imagine a lot of companies would face this. You know, it's easy to want to hire somebody who's very similar to you, right? Who has a similar personality or this or that. You almost have to look past a lot of that. I think naturally people gravitate towards people who maybe even share the same, you know, opinions about whatever. It could be anything. It could be politics. So kind of moving past that, you almost have to be intentional about just, okay, you know, you got to set those aside and, you know, hire based on culture, which is we've defined in this, that it's the value for your customers. It's the business principles that you guys have. It's keeping everybody, free to kind of have discussions and conversations. So, you know, trying to be intentional in that, you know, I could see it just being such a big issue for some people who, you know, if you bring somebody in who might have a difference of opinion, just even from a political perspective or sports team, for crying out loud, you don't want to shake any feathers. And it's not necessarily that, you know, you're trying to be, you know, that person, you know, I don't want to hire them for this reason or that reason. It's just, it's almost like, well, I don't want to do this because I don't want to shake the bush here. You know, I don't want to go out and cause, you know, issues with my devs who are doing great work. Bring in somebody who can kind of, you know, like we discussed, they'd have to be a culture fit. So I was trying to define what culture meant. Yeah. And it becomes a little fuzzy because it's almost naturally as humans, we seem to just gravitate toward that. It's just how we get along with friends and people in our lives anyway. So is there anything, I mean, I don't know how intentional you have to be about it, but like, is there anything that you guys do specifically to, you know, make sure that you're not hiring somebody based on, oh, he fits really well with this manager, or, you know, he works really well with this other guy over here for, you know, is there anything you guys do to kind of keep that in check?
Well, those things that you touched on are probably not things that we would dismiss a potential move or candidate for, right? You know, just because they do have a good fit or a good relationship, right, or not necessarily, that's not something that we should look or dismiss for the fear that it might be. I think you just have to evaluate it is, because that exists, am I weighting that appropriately to make the right decision for this role? Is, again, it goes back to kind of, is this the easy button, you know, right, to fill this gap or to fill the solution? Have I really thought? And a lot of hiring managers just aren't given the time, like because they're usually wearing a lot of hats. And that's kind of the sad state of affairs when it comes to IT leadership, yeah, is that, hey, you know, new project just came, I need to go hire 5 engineers, and someone told me I got to get it done in 6 months, right? And so how much time are we really putting into evaluating those candidates and making, you know, like, right, we got to let people, you know, if we're really invested in developing that culture and in developing the individuals, then we've got to give hiring managers, you know, time. But oftentimes in our space, you know, that's, you time is that not luxury. A luxury. Yeah. And, But so then, you know, kind of where do we go, right? And, you know, where do we go from there with that being the case? But I think it really does come down to being thoughtful in your consideration, you know, that we're really meeting kind of the full set of criteria for that role that, yeah, we're trying to hire, and not rushing into it because an, yeah, opportunity exists, you know, whether with an existing employee or with an external candidate that we're looking at. Yeah.
So I guess what we're saying is, you know, it's there. It's always probably going to be there, this affinity bias. So, yeah, as long as we're not using it for, I guess, the wrong reasons or, you know, self-serving reasons, you know, utilizing it. It's not necessarily, from what I'm understanding, what I'm hearing, it's not necessarily always a bad thing. You know, if you can have people be a part of the team that get along, that makes everybody's, yeah, job easier, right?
Yeah. And I think the manager has to keep their finger on the pulse of just, if we see opportunities for more challenging of ideas, right? Like, how do you then, because maybe it's not a new hire, but it's just like, you see too much, hey, we're going along kind of with the flow a little bit too much. How do we get a little more kind of devil's advocate happening in here to refine some of these ideas, right? Like, and to ultimately have the best ideas and emerge, and the solutions emerge from those discussions. So, but again, I think managers have to be engaged in there. Again, it comes back to that facilitation, mm-hmm, right, to help kind of make sure that team never loses that edge, right? Because at some point, absolutely, they probably did come in with their own set of experiences, mm-hmm, and through time they started to develop a better rapport and working rhythm, and that's a good thing too, but you also want to make sure that they don't get complacent, right? And right, then how do you stay sharp as a well-oiled kind of well-aligned team?
Yeah, sure. Leadership sounds difficult, dude. I don't know why anybody wants to do it.
Stay away from
a lot
from
of
that.
Balancing, a, yeah, lot of, you know.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So one of the happy accidents that happened in my career is when I started at Iowa State, their MIS program was new. So they didn't and so basically what they did was they just took all the business core curriculum courses and then added computer science to it. Like, mm-hmm, so you took a lot of the same, almost all the same computer science classes, then you just took accounting and finance and management and all that stuff with it, which was awesome for me. For me, it was like the best of both worlds, because I'd rather do that than take physics and chemistry and all, and, you know, all this other stuff.
Sure.
And I've leaned upon a lot of that learning that I got from those business oriented classes.
It's great to hear.
But it's not always the case. Yeah, but it's not structured that way anymore. Yeah. To my knowledge, is that that role is more the way they've built that program is around.
Well, I hate to say it, but oftentimes when we interviewing somebody who has a computer science degree, it's like, oh goodness, we might have to adjust their thinking a little bit, because they might, it's school knowledge is great, but it's not the same as sometimes the real world.
But that's interesting, because he got the view of the business side as well as the technical side.
Awesome.
Yes, yeah.
And
yeah.
nowadays it's, you don't get very many software engineers that are coming out, or software developers at least, that are coming out with degrees.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are going to boot camps and
stuff
like that.
I started organic. I didn't do any of this in college.
So
it got to work out for me.
Some of the best engineers I know are music majors, right?
Isn't that a weird thing?
Yeah.
I interviewed a young lady that was a...
I wonder if that's a personality thing. I know a lot of developers who are also musicians or into music in some fashion.
Right. So this young lady played in the symphony, and she was saying there's a huge correlation between
interesting.
The two.
Yeah.
Math, of course, you always see math majors a lot of times will make great developers, but it's kind of the music. Yeah. I'd never made the connection before.
Yeah.
Like I said, that was a little bit of a happy accident there for me, and it was
great.
Yeah,
worked out.
Very, very fortunate.
Yeah,
for
that's
it.
Awesome.
And also good people on the way. Is like, you can't, the architects and the managers and everyone who kind of spent time with me to kind of help.
It's almost like it was set up, it's like it just happened, I feel very similar in my journey personally.
Well, and it sounded like you reached out to people, mentors, for advice, and I think that's a big thing too.
Acknowledging that something was off, right? I think was kind of a big part for me, is just that I think there's more that I can do. And I think most people, there is more, right, of that untapped potential that exists within folks. But whether it's just the work that just kind of washes over them, and they just don't have the ability to kind of have their head, get above the water, to recognize it, or they just haven't had people come alongside them to help see it.
Right.
And then again, that's where managers and leaders have to be equipped with those skills to meet people in those moments and navigate their career and help them not just meet business objectives, but help them become the best versions of themselves, right? Because then that ultimately then brings you back to better business, better at meeting business objectives.
How does one find a mentor? Like I had a mentor, but that was sort of happened. Yeah. But like, there's a lot of people like boot camps, like, oh, I'm going to change my careers. I'm going to go this boot camp and I'm going to be a developer. Do you have any advice for how people like that would find a mentor, somebody to help sort of guide them? Do you feel like they would do that through the boot camp? It is challenging to be completely by yourself, to navigate all of this.
Yeah. I think now it seems like there's a lot of podcasts. And so one of our software leads has a podcast specifically for young developers, right? People that are just trying to break into the industry and giving advice to those folks and say, hey, don't kill yourself here, or really pay attention here, or this is important, this stuff isn't important, the stuff that you got to know. So I guess a little of that, but then a lot of it's a luck of the draw. Where you're working and who you come in contact with.
Within our company, we do try to create communities, right, so that it creates, kind of fosters the opportunity for those kind of relationships to develop naturally. So we kind of have an engineering standards and practices community that comes together and meets, and they talk about different topics. It's also a way for people to demonstrate something that they've learned or that they find interesting to a larger group.
They don't feel on the spot doing that. Do they enjoy that?
They do. And so again, it comes down to there are people who are passionate and who want to be better at that. Right. And so they're kind of coming forward, and that gives them a platform to do it. And then we also, use it. The fact that it exists gives our managers another tool that's like, you know, to go along to maybe that shy person or that maybe not so outgoing person, like, you can do this, right? And here's a great opportunity for you to be able to step out within a space of your peers that you feel more comfortable with, so that you can develop that opportunity to be more confident in the way that you talk about technical solutions.
Well, that's great.
In larger
almost
audiences.
Defeats that imposter syndrome, you know. Right. Like, no, that's I actually really like that idea.
I've learned so much in my career through teaching, right? That like when I have to go teach something, right, then I become a lot more confident.
Well, you're forced to understand it. That
right?
Way,
exactly. Yeah, it's like I don't want to look like an idiot. But yeah, we want to create those opportunities for everyone. And that's because, again, these aren't skills that people are just inherently born with. Definitely something that I had the luxury of, you know, having opportunities in my career to develop these skills. They didn't just happen.
Right.
And so when it goes coming back to culture, you know, companies have to invest in that.
Yeah.
Right. If we're only focused on the business outcomes, right, then, you know, you can do that, but then, you know, the people are going to disengage at some point,
right?
If that is the only focal point. So it's got to be kind of a shared journey together, right?
One of our, one of the podcasts, it's not out yet, the guest was talking about how much of an introvert he was when he was in college and how he had overcome that. And that is such a huge thing, you know, right? In the software engineers, just in general, the stereotype at least. Quiet nerds and stuff like that.
So I had to take a speech class in college and I was the worst public speaker. And I got a D and an F. I'll just go on the record saying a D and an F on my first two speeches. And, all the things, whether it was...
Wow, that's got to be kind of like, hey, I'm going to go do this, but you failed. That's Wow.
But again, it comes down to getting punched in the face. What do you do next? You know, didn't have to do it, but went and talked to my TA in speech class and said... I'm struggling. Like I want to do this well, and I know I can do this, but I don't have the tools to do this on my own, right? And she was amazing, and then she's like, hey, you know, make sure you've got a good outline when you come to you got to practice, like you got to get in front of that mirror. You know, these are timed speeches, so you got to kind of get that pressure out of your system before you come in here.
Sure.
Like, and so she like walked me through, you know, the system, and then I committed to it, you know, like that's like, okay. So started doing what she said, and then boom, you know, like B right out of the gate, even though when I thought I was doing well, like I tell this story to my managers as I'm trying to like encourage them and get better at public speaking. And so I'm confident, I can see that the audience is engaged and I'm given this persuasive speech. But then all of a sudden I see everyone's looking at me funny all of a sudden. And what was happening in my hand, it was holding my 3x5, was shaking violently, like from being nervous.
Scared,
And I literally had to grab my hand and I gave the rest of the speech, you know, like, and that delivered it like this, but, you know, ultimately got over, you know, that fear of getting in front of people. But that lack of not accepting that shortcoming as that's the end,
right.
was an important fork in the road for me. Like, because I think all too many people, software engineers or whoever, you know, say, this is just who I am.
Yeah.
Right. This is,
they
and
give
I
up.
Just
don't
accept,
push
yeah,
through.
I'm an introvert. And this is kind of the damage that, you know, kind of labels can do, is that they can be restricting and confining, and we want to make sure that, you know, engineers are kind of on their path and have that opportunity to evolve and develop into the best version of themselves. And that sometimes means breaking through some pretty significant barriers, right?
Yeah.
It's been
psychological
awesome.
Barriers. That's crazy. Yeah. Well, if it means anything, I give you an A+ today. You did fantastic.
Well, I need a lot of encouragement, you know, to be able to get through my day. So I do appreciate that.